Okay, let's go ahead and get started. We appreciate you being here. Just want to remind you, this is a public meeting where we take comments and questions and proposals from the public, and consider that in our in what we recommend to the Wildlife Board. We'd like to first have the RAC introduce themselves. Go ahead, Ken. We'll start with Ken.
Ken Strong, Sportsman's Rep.
Ben Louder, Public at Large.
Matt Clark, Sportsman's Rep.
Chris Marble, Public at Large.
Larry Fitzgerald, Agricultural.
George Garcia, Forest Service.
Chris Schmitz, Non-Consumptive.
I'm Richard Hansen. I'm a large. There's three of us that are dead men walking right now. But to my left is is Jason Vernon. He's the director for the Central Region. And we have Debbie and Jenny. They are making sure that the notes are taken properly. Let me explain a little bit about how the meeting will go. On the RAC procedure, the division will make a presentation. Then there will be questions that about the presentation from the RAC, and then the public can come up and ask questions. Then there will be a comment period for the public, and I want to emphasize that when you come up in the question period after the presentation, it's questions only. So please don't try to present any comments or anything at that point. And then after the public has made their comments, we'll call you up with these cards, and if any of you haven't signed, filled out a card and would like to make a comment, please get them up to us, and I'll call them up during the comment period, and you can make your comments at that point. There'll be 3 minutes for individuals, and if you represent a group or organization, you have 5 minutes. After that point, then we'll bring it back to the RAC, and they will discuss it, make any comments, any motions at that point. We'd like to first, we need to an approval of the agenda and minutes, and hopefully all of you have had a chance, the RAC has had a chance to review that, and I will entertain a motion concerning the minutes and the agenda. Chris?
I'll make a motion to approve the minutes from the previous meeting.
Okay. Larry, second it. We can vote on this, but it's non-binding. Okay. The reason why is because we don't have a quorum. So we will still record your votes on that. So all in favor of the motion? 8. So. I hope so. If we're not. Yeah, but I'm a non-voting, though. That's the problem. Just vote if it's a tie. Okay, let's go for it, and we'll just assume that this is a legit voting block. Okay. So we have. Oh, Ron. Okay, then that will be really good. Ron, we've been waiting for you to start the meeting.
It only took an hour,
10 minutes
or so. Good traffic.
Ron Camp, he's a sportsman's rep. Okay, we have a motion for the to approve the minutes and the agenda for tonight. The vote was maybe, Ron, would you like to vote on this with us?
Yes, I'm voting, yeah.
Okay. All in favor of the motion again? Okay. 7-4. Any against? Okay. One abstention. 7-4, one abstention. Okay. Okay. Let's go to the information concerning the Wildlife Board meeting. I don't have any draft of the minutes, and also I'll do the best I can to go through the items that were presented there and how that was voted. There was an interesting subject concerning the Pottsgaunt cactus buck research. They held an update on that, and they're trying to determine why cactus bucks exist and why there is, in certain areas, there are seem to be more than others. And that study will continue on at the end. Then they'll bring out some recommendations. There was even some talk about creating a cactus buck deer season for only cactus bucks on the Pottsgaunt. On the bucks, bulls, and once-in-a-lifetime permit recommendations, the vote on that was unanimous. On the antlers permit recommendations, the vote on that was also unanimous. They did, and one thing I think we need to I need to bring up is they will instituted something that came from this rack. Originally was that private lands permits for antlerless elk on the Vernon unit in that area. So I want you all to know that it matters to them what the racks do and how they vote. the antlerless permit recommendations, the vote was unanimous on that. The there was a CWMU antlerless variance requests. That was the decrease, increase, approval of different CWMUs. That was voted on, and that was unanimous. There was also a variance request on a CWMU that Larry actually was involved in, Larry Fitzgerald, and by the upon the Wasatch unit, and that. After a lot of discussion, and it came out that three of the racks actually voted for that variance and two against, but it was also the CWMU committee also voted to approve that variance, and that passed the Wildlife Board. So it matters. Thank you for being involved in that. And then the chairman, John Bear, made about 15,000 motions himself. I guess it's legal to do that by the chairman, but not normal. So with that, we'll go to Jason, and he'll give an update on our region.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple things I'd like to report on. From a wildlife section, this last week and into the next couple weeks, they've started doing their spring range rides across the winter range, as well as some habitat assessment, looking at the range to see how it is, how the deer affected it over this winter time. Also, a few weeks ago, they finished their pronghorn antelope classification. The aquatic section, this week, over the last couple of days and into tomorrow, they're doing their spring gill netting up on Jordanelle Reservoir. And one thing they reported is today they caught a 15-inch tiger muskie out of the reservoir. And these fish were just stocked last July at a little under 6 inches probably. So over, 9 to 10 months, they grew 9 to 10 inches. So that's pretty impressive and still encouraging for the reservoir. In a couple weeks, on April 11th of last month, they stocked about 250,000 3.5-inch kokanee into the Jordanelle Reservoir as well. And they're preparing to stock some rainbows, 18,000 12-inch rainbows in the reservoir as part of kind of a research project to look at the size of, look at the rainbows and as we stock them at different sizes and what kind of return we get on those rainbows. I think it was two weekends ago, they had a fish for garbage event and had a lot of angling groups on the Provo River pick up a lot of trash. So we really appreciate those anglers and lending a hand up there. They did a great job, and I don't know if you saw on Facebook, there's great big huge piles of trash that they pulled off the river there. So it was a great effort by the anglers. We really appreciate that. They've been doing quite a few habitat improvement efforts on community ponds. One of note was they installed over 40 structures on Pole Canyon Pond in Santa Quinn City. And the structures were built and dedicated by Boy Scouts as part of an Eagle Scout project. And just wanted to say thanks to Santa Quinn City and the Scouts, and our community fisheries biologist Shante was involved with that as well, and a lot of good work going on in our community fisheries. Kind of along those same lines for our outreach section, before we meet again in June, there will be Free Fishing Day. That's on June 10th. It's a Saturday. It's a one day of the year where you don't have to have a license to go fishing. So we encourage everybody to get out and try to catch a fish. There's a couple things going on in conjunction with that. In our region, there will be a cutthroat viewing day held on June 10th also at Strawberry Reservoir, where you'll be able to go into the visitor center there and into the fish trap and see the cutthroat that are spawning there. Also that same weekend up in Salt Lake at the Lee K Center, they hold the division along with other partners, Cabela's and Sportsman's Warehouse, and hold what's called Outdoor Adventure Days. And it's been a great event. I think this might be the third year maybe that they've had it. Spend a lot of time outside. It's free. They've got fishing, of course, at the Lee K Center. You can shoot guns, ATV riding, kayaking. They've got all kinds of things set up there. Get people excited about being in the outdoors. On May 9th, next Tuesday, I believe that is, there's a fishing event at Salem Pond. It's a youth fishing event. It begins at 8 a.m. and ends around 3 o'clock, but this is something that's been going on for about, I don't know, maybe 25 years or something like that, I think. 9 to 2 is when it'll be. So we're excited for that. We love doing it, but it is something that dedicated hunters can get some hours for. So if you're interested in that, we've got a lot of things on the website for dedicated hunters to do to get their hours. So visit the website and sign up for some of those. A lot of fishing events, some with youth at some ponds in May. So just a lot of things for dedicated hunters to get involved with. In our habitat section, it's that time of the year, just like your yards, we're kind of cleaning up our WMAs, our wildlife management areas. So we've been out visiting the WMAs, see how they came through the winter, looking to make repairs where necessary, fences, whatever may have happened there, to spruce those up. And one thing that I found I was excited about is they'll be installing 17 upland game guzzlers this summer out on the Keg Mountains and the Simpsons and on the ranges out there. They have identified locations for 11 of those guzzlers, and they're currently working with the BLM to find locations for the others. But 17 guzzlers is a pretty good attempt for this summer, so we're excited about that. And that's kind of all I have for my regional update. But as Richard mentioned, I guess we have three dead men walking tonight. We have three members of our RAC that this will be their final meeting. And we appreciate the time. I was talking with Matt, and I think all of you probably have 8 years. Is that two terms on the RAC? So 8 years of dedicated service for wildlife. Being at these meetings, I think we have 6 meetings a year, plus all the time you spend studying for those. Paying attention to the Wildlife Board and everything else that goes on. So I just want to show my appreciate all the effort and time that's been put into those. And I have some gifts here I'll hand out to them. And
wanted to try to get something practical, so I got each of them 11, and so hopefully you can fix some fence or do something constructive with those. And also, Division put together a coin this year, a commemorative coin for 2017. On one side, it's got our logo, and on the other side, it's got a mule deer with the date on it, 2017. So something useful and something commemorative that doesn't show how much we appreciate your help, but hopefully it's something you can enjoy. So maybe we can give them a hand.
Mr. Chair, that's all I have, and thank you.
Thank you. Okay, let's go to the presentations. Jason Robinson from the Division Upland Game Coordinator.
Do you want to switch that around?
Excuse me. We made a change on that. Let's have Blair Stringham come up. Sorry, Blair. He has some information concerning the Tempe Springs Habitat Management Plan.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'll run through this real quick. This is an informational item, so it's not something to be voted on by the RAC. It's basically just to update you on what we've done with the Tempe Springs area. It's located out along I-80 as you're heading towards Wendover. Just giving an update on what this management plan will be and kind of inform you on what's happening out there. So we go through a review process for each one of our waterfowl management areas and wildlife management areas. The process for that is for the regional staff to go through and evaluate the current management plan and update it accordingly. That then goes through our Habitat Council and then through an RDCC process, which is essentially the governor's office giving their blessing. Along with this, we also can share these with county commissioners, RACs, as well as Wildlife Board, just to give them an update on exactly what this process is and what we're doing on our division properties. So the purpose of these plan is to essentially outline all the uses that we envision for each one of these properties. We also go through and identify any of the challenges that we foresee with these properties. We document any existing conditions and put together a plan for any of the desired vegetation community types that we want to see on these properties. It also includes the strategies for how we'll achieve these future conditions, as well as any of the resources that we're reallocating, such as forage, water, and things like that. So this is Tempe Springs right here. Its property is largely dominated by saltgrass with plants that will grow in very, very high soil salt conditions. So this is typically what most of the property at Tempe Springs looks like. It's a good property for waterfowl as well as shorebirds primarily. It's located about 15 to 20 miles west of Stansbury Park, right in the north end of the Stansbury Mountains. The property is just off of exit 77, just to the right of the mineral salt development out there. The property consists of about 1,400 acres of water. It's one of the only freshwater wetland impoundments on the south end of the Great Salt Lake. It was developed back in the 1930s. A Big Spring Gun Club originally started developing it. That land was then transferred to BLM, and we acquired it about 1981. We acquired half the property at that time and then got the other half from CITLA a couple of years ago through a land trade. The purpose of the WMA is essentially to provide wildlife habitat. We have both waterfowl species as well as a variety of upland water birds out there. And we also have some sensitive species that use the area, so it's managed for them as well. There's some cultural resources there that we're protecting, and we also provide recreational opportunities. It's primarily used by waterfowl hunters, but our viewing opportunities and other things there. And so as far as wildlife, we've documented 103 different avian species that use this property. Six of those are species of greatest conservation concern, which are in our WAP plan. The recreational opportunities are primarily waterfowl hunting and viewing opportunities. We also have what's called the concrete arrow out there. As you may have guessed, it's a giant concrete arrow. It was used for early navigation by pilots as they were going back and forth across the United States. And it's what they use before they had lights and things like that for people to help them through navigation. So it does bring in quite a few people coming to check this out every year. Access is allowed on the property year-round. Firearms are only allowed during the waterfowl hunting season. And motor vehicles are prohibited outside of the main driving area. So there's a parking lot, and then outside of that, it's only accessed by foot or bicycle. As far as habitat, for the most part, it's a pretty unique property and doesn't have a whole lot of weed issues. There is Phragmites on the property, and there is some of that that needs to be removed, as well as just overall cleanup. Occasionally get a lot of trash out there, and there also are some railroad ties and things like that that still exist on a property that need to be removed. For some of the surveys that we do out there, we do a waterfowl and a non-game bird survey every year. And we also do different surveys for different mammals, reptiles, amphibian species, and things like that. Some of the needs out there, I'm constantly repairing fences, putting up new signs that get shot, and things like that. Also maintaining and removing any of the noxious weeds that may spring up on the property. We also have a peregrine falcon tower out there as well that's used and is in need of repair that needs to be done soon. So overall, after we went through this review process, it was found that really no changes were recommended for the property, and so nothing's really changed with the management plan other than just a couple updates for literature and data and things like that. So that's all I have. Thank you.
Thanks, Blair. Any questions or comments from anyone concerning this? Okay. Good. Thank you. Okay, let's, Jason Robinson, Upland Game and Turkey Hunt Table Recommendations.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Good evening. I'm Jason Robinson. I'm the Upland Game Coordinator for the Division of Wildlife out of our Salt Lake office. I'm going to be presenting the Upland Game and Turkey Guidebook Recommendations. So before we jump into it, just a little bit of background on Upland Game, just kind of a refresher that Upland Game are very different than big game biologically, and so we manage them differently. Upland Game experience boom and bust cycles. They're generally short-lived. Many of the species only live to be 1 or 2 years old. Populations are largely dependent on annual production and survival. Annual survival rates can be low. In a healthy pheasant population, 80-90% of the birds can die each year and recover from that each year. And hunters generally account for less than 10% of the take of the annual population. And one of the things that's really important for tonight is population cycle largely independent of hunter harvest. It's really weather and climate driven. We also see what we call the law of diminishing returns, which basically means that in years where we have a lot of upland game, hunters go out, they have a good hunt, they tell their friends, so the friends go out. And so we see hunter numbers kind of follow population trends. And the reverse is also true. Years where the populations are low, hunters go out, don't see quite as many, tell their friends it wasn't worth going. So hunter numbers usually kind of go down with that as well. And so that's kind of an inherent protection for upland game species. We also have fairly liberal season lengths and bag limits, so we can spread the opportunity out over both time and space throughout the state. So what really all this comes down to is a 3-year guidebook makes sense biologically. It also does from our standpoint administratively, but the big point there is it really does make sense to just do this about every 3 years. One of the things to note as well, because we're doing a three-year guidebook, we'll cover 3 consecutive years. So in a couple of cases, fixed date openers might open on a Sunday, which isn't allowed in Utah. So in that case, we would recommend to just move the hunt to the Monday after that. As example, in 2019, September 1 falls on a Sunday. We would recommend opening that on September 2nd, just the following day. So jumping right into the recommendations for each of the species, we do have 20 upland game species that I'll be discussing tonight. With that many species, I'll kind of just highlight some of the changes that we're making and maybe talk about those a little bit. Where we're not making changes, I'll probably go a little bit quick over those. So jumping right into it, California and Gamble's quail, we are not recommending any changes for those species. So a statewide hunt, first Saturday in November to the end of December, with a three-time daily bag for our possession and a harvest of a bag limit of five per day. Chukar and gray partridge, Hungarian partridge, we are not recommending any changes for those as well. That would be statewide last Saturday in September to February 15th, which is a fixed day. Keep the youth hunt the same, and then five birds of each species per day. Ringneck pheasant. So this is an area where we are recommending a change from the past. In the past, we've had two seasons. We've had a two-week statewide hunt, and then following that, private lands are closed, and it's open on for another 2 weeks, essentially, on state and federal and leased lands. What we've seen over the last few years is that's causing some confusion with our walk-in access, and people are having a hard time. So what we are recommending is to just do it more like the other hunts, where we have a statewide pheasant season that runs from the first Saturday in November to the first Sunday in December. Really simplifies it for pheasant hunters, folks that are out there, especially with the efforts the division's been putting out, birds for hunters. Just makes it a lot easier for hunters, and there won't be any biological impacts because we're just harvesting males during that hunt. Continue with the youth hunt with the Saturday through Monday, close to the 13th of October, and then a bag limit of two males. Dusky and ruffed grouse are forest grouse. We're not recommending any changes there statewide, September 1 to December 31st, with a four per day bag. Greater sage grouse. So we do have a hunt here in Utah for greater sage grouse. It's most of the state is closed with four areas open. We would like to continue the permit allocation system, so no changes there. For your information, again, most of the state is closed with four areas open, with a harvest of less than 3% of the statewide population. And then we would recommend allocating 15% to the youth hunters. So there's the recommendation. Again, no change from the past, with season dates of last Saturday in September to the Sunday 3 weeks later, and then the bag limit is two per year. Sharptail grouse, very similar to sage grouse. No recommended changes. We would like to continue with the permit allocation system, offer a two-bird permit. 15% of those permits are set aside for youth hunters. Two areas of the state are open, Northeast Box Elder and Cache County. The season dates are the same for as they are for sage grouse. Bag limit of two per year, so no changes. White-tailed ptarmigan. We would recommend no changes here either. It's a statewide hunt from the fourth Saturday in August to October 31st with a bag of four. Wild turkeys. So we manage wild turkeys a little bit differently than other upland game species. We have three performance targets that we look at each year for our turkey hunts, and this is the spring turkey hunt. So we look at the three-year average of hunter success, and we want that to be greater than 20%. We look at the three-year average of hunter crowding, and we want that to be less than four on a 1 to 5 scale, with five being very crowded. We look at the three-year average of hunter satisfaction. We want that to be greater than two on a 1 to 5 scale, with five being very satisfied. So here's some data for the last few years, showing on the yellow line total permits. 2010 was the first year we offered the over-the-counter or the general season in the spring. You can see last few years we've been increasing in total permits and total harvest of birds. Hunter success, we've had a three-year average hunter success of 32.3%, so above that 20% threshold. So that trigger has not been met, which means we're doing good. Hunter satisfaction, a three-year average hunter success, hunter satisfaction of 3.8. So what that means is hunters are very satisfied with the hunt. You can see the trend over time. It's actually been increasing the satisfaction. Hunter crowding equals 2.2. Of note on this graph is the green line on the top shows the numbers of hunters afield. And so for the past few years, we've been increasing the number of hunters out on the landscape. But our crowding index, the way people feel if they felt crowded or not, has remained steady, which is good, which means hunters are dispersing themselves across the landscape and not feeling crowded. So not, that trigger wasn't met either. So we have hunters can take one bird in the spring, a bearded wild turkey. We offer a hunt for hunters with disability. They can apply for a 3-day season extension. We offer a limited entry regional hunt. So there's 5 regions within the state. Opens the second Saturday in April, closes last Thursday in April. And then we would like to continue an annual limited entry permit allocation system, similar to what we do with sage grouse and sharp-tailed grouse. And then we also offer a general statewide hunt. So our recommendation is to not change anything from the past. With the fall wild turkey, so we've gone from spring to fall turkey. Overall, we would like to keep things. We are not recommending any changes with the fall wild turkey hunt as well. Our main objective is reducing human-turkey conflicts. Those are sold over the counter, first come, first serve. It's been working quite well, and so we don't see a need for any changes at this point. Snowshoe hare. We are not recommending any changes for snowshoe hare. It's a statewide hunt, September 1 through March 15th, with a bag of 5. Cottontail rabbits, we are not recommending any changes there either. It's a statewide hunt, September 1 through February 28th, with a bag of 10. Falconry recommendation, we're not recommending any changes for falconry. They have a 6-month season currently. They have basically the same bag in possession as all other upland game hunters. And we do allow falconry on fall wild turkey, but not on spring wild turkey. So we're going to shift gears a little bit here, and we're going to jump into migratory upland game species. So there's 5 species of birds in Utah that are managed through the flyway process. And so they have basically the Migratory Bird Treaty Act of 1918. So managed more like waterfowl than they are upland game, but they're included in the Upland Game Guidebook. Those include band-tailed pigeon, sandhill crane, American crow, mourning, and white-winged dove. With that, they also require a harvest information program number or a HIP number. And just a little bit of information why I'm talking. It is required for those 5 species. We are going to change how hunters get these numbers, the HIP number moving forward. We want to move to an online system so a person can get their HIP number on their smartphone in the field or on their home computer. And this takes effect this fall, and really what it's going to do is it's going to make it much easier and faster for hunters to be able to get their HIP. Good. So we'll look forward to that this year. I think it'll be really a great product for us. So moving back into the recommendations, band-tailed pigeons. We are not recommending any changes here. A hunter must obtain a free band-tailed pigeon permit. It's statewide, September 1 through 14, with a bag of 2. Sandhill cranes. So we're recommending no changes in rich, cash, and east box elder. We are recommending a change in Uinta County. We met with those folks, and they would like to see the season moved back into October. That's when most of the cranes are in that county. It would help landowners as well as hunters be more successful. And so we're recommending early, mid, and late season hunt. Each of them would be 10 days long, with the first hunt opening on the Saturday closest to October 1. Bag in possession is 1 per year. Mourning and white-winged dove, we're not recommending any changes there. Basically, September 1 through October 30th, for mourning and white wings with a bag of 15. Collared doves are year-round statewide, no limit no hunting license required, and some of the rare doves are closed to hunting. American crow, we are not recommending any changes to the American crow hunt. It's a split season statewide with a bag of 10. Migratory upland game falconry recommendations, we're not recommending any changes to that. Bandtail pigeon, mourning, and white-winged dove is September 1 through December 16th, bag of 3. Crow is the same as for gun hunters, and then sandhill cranes are closed to falconry. We had a couple of board action items that we wanted to bring to the racks as well. The first one was a youth hunt on WMAs for upland game. One of the things we were asked was to provide a list of youth hunting opportunities. So that's provided in your rack packet for last year. We are also recommending closing the Pavant and Annabella WMAs in the southern region to the general public on the second Saturday of November for a youth pheasant hunt. It's a long ongoing hunt that the division's done for a number of years on and it's during the pheasant season. Hasn't been an issue, but the region down there would like to make it known in the guidebook that that's closed and just open to those that have signed up for that youth hunting opportunity. The second board action item was the board asked us to look at the order of the turkey hunts, specifically to eliminate the limited entry turkey draw and replace it with over-the-counter. As was presented earlier, we are not recommending any changes to the current hunt structure. None of our management triggers have been met. In other words, hunters are successful and satisfied and not very crowded, so we're not recommending any changes there. A couple of housekeeping items. Rule 657-6, taking upland game. We made some minor editorial corrections that are in your rack packet. And we made some corrections and clarification on baiting upland game just to make it easier for people to understand what is and is not baiting. Rule 657-54, taking wild turkeys. Same kinds of things, a couple of minor editorial corrections, and then again made some clarification on baiting wild turkeys. That's all I have. Thank you.
Hey, thank you, Jason. Any questions from the rack on the presentation? Matt?
Jason, I have a question. First of all, I think this is a great, great proposal and support it wholeheartedly. The division has aggressively been planning pheasants the last few years on the WMAs. Are you going to continue to do that? And if so, do any of those pheasants naturally reproduce and make it through the season or through the winter?
So first part of your question is, yeah, we have plans to continue that into the future. We've entered into a five-year contract with the grower. So, yeah, our plan is to continue that. The second part, we only release male pheasants. If there are hens there, obviously we're not releasing hens to increase the population. So our main focus is releasing males for hunters to harvest. We do know that a very small percentage of those will carry over, but it's in the realm of maybe 1-2% that actually carry over. The majority of those are harvested by hunters during the hunting season, which is the main objective of the program.
Ken.
Yes, Justin. Have you guys considered doing a program such as what they're doing in Sevier County, where the pheasant population, by the way, is starting to increase in the wild, and that's a program where they're paying for reward, I guess, for trapping the raccoons and the skunks and the foxes? It's made a big difference, and around here we don't have any kind of a program like that, and that's where our pheasants have gone. I mean, when I was a kid, the pheasant hunt in Utah was 3 days and three roosters, and sometimes there was two roosters and one hen, and there was hundreds and hundreds of pheasants. So we don't have that anymore, mostly because of the predators that we have. But we need to do something about the predators, and I think that's something that... I'm just curious if you've thought about doing anything for the predators, such as Sevier County, where they have a program where they pay for a bounty on predators.
Yeah, so here in the state, many of the predators you listed are not protected, so a person can go and trap or hunt those whenever they'd like. We do contract out with Wildlife Services to do predator control work specific for upland game here in the state. It's not a bounty program like we have in there is in Sevier County. There is the coyote bounty program that's statewide. And yeah, we talk a lot about predators, but there's nothing, I guess, in the works specific in similar to what's going on in Sevier County.
Larry.
That was going to be my question too, Ken, about predation. You didn't bring in your... You didn't really say much about predation. It's not only the coyote skunks. It's you go as far as the raven, and even as far as the magpie, and then even as far as the seagull, doing predation on some of these younger birds. I think that would be. I think that's one of your main reasons why you don't, especially don't have the ringneck pheasants. But that's a issue on all of these birds. It's on the sage grouse, and it's even on the wild turkey. The Vernon, you had a really healthy herd of wild turkeys a few years back, and now it's very hard to find a wild turkey in the Vernon. And even in the Wasatch with the greater sage grouse, it's the foxes, the coyotes, and that is something I think that the division needs to take a look at if they ever want continue a healthy bird population in the state. So is that something that, along with Ken's comments, is that something the division is going to look into?
Yeah, I mean, it's something we're always talking about. You know, we want to try and balance, you know, as much as we can. You know, each of those species has different criteria. You know, some of them are managed through the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, ravens and crows and magpies. Some of them are unprotected wildlife, red fox. As I mentioned, you know, we contract with Wildlife Services to try and focus that predator control effort. So, yeah, I mean, it's something we definitely address and talk about.
Maybe, Ken, we could maybe recommend something that they would look at something.
Yeah, I don't know if this is the time to do it or not.
No, but, you know, just for clarification, so...
Jason, I have a question. Did you look at increasing the number of fall turkey hunting areas?
Yeah, so that's, as I mentioned, it's the main objective of that hunt is to deal with turkey-human conflicts. Because fall hunts, they are an either-sex hunt, so a hunter can take either a male or a female. Depending on the level that we harvest birds, it can actually... stop growth or even make the population decline if you offer a whole bunch of permits. So it's a very useful tool for us, but in many parts of the state we're still trying to grow our turkey populations. So what we do is we have the regional staff look at it each year, estimate the number of turkeys that are causing, and the proposal we have here gives us the maximum flexibility to be able to do that, to really go into those areas that need to have turkeys reduced, but not go in there and reduce populations that we want to continue to grow.
Hey, I just know an area up Salt Creek Canyon above Nephi that the landowners up there aren't real happy with them. And I'm sure you're aware of that, but yes. Wondered if you'd considered a fall hunt there.
Yeah, we've talked about it, and usually the decision's made at the regional level, so the regional staff can decide. If it's to the stage that we need to look into offering a fall hunt. So Riley would basically be the one to kind of make that call.
Okay, thank you. Chris.
Just a quick question. We received a suggestion for a split chucker season due to some access concerns in the West Desert. Just wondering if you've heard any other concerns or if that suggestion has been brought up previously?
That's the first time I've heard of that suggestion to do kind of a split chucker season. I guess what I would recommend and what the division recommended was to keep it the way it is. And the reason for that is chuckers rely on water, especially young chuckers in July and August. They're very tied to guzzlers, as was mentioned earlier. And so we time the hunt to coincide with the time when the chuckers are less reliant on those guzzlers. And if we open it much earlier, you could have a negative impact on the population where those birds are concentrated at those water sources.
Can you refresh my memory what the season dates are on that chucker hunt?
It's the last Saturday in September to February 15th.
February 15th?
Yep.
Okay.
So, Ben, are you going to go out there with a flu arrow?
That might be a little difficult on a chucker. I've done it on pheasants. Chuckers, no.
Yeah, that'd be impressive. Okay, any other questions from the rack? Okay, seeing none, any questions from the audience on the presentation? Come ahead, just state your name.
My name is Rob Fitzgerald. I've just got a quick question for you. Down in Benjamin, where I'm from, down around the lake, we've noticed a really significant increase in the sandhill cranes. In fact, a lot of our neighbors are complaining about crop damage and problems, especially the last few years. In fact, last year, lots of times during the winter, we would see more cranes than we would the geese down there. Is there any plans to extend the hunt, or are they going to do any mitigation on that, or is there any plans at all for the sandhills in Utah County?
Let me actually have Blair Stringham, our migratory bird coordinator, answer that one.
So the way that our crane hunts are based is by areas in the state that have the highest amount of damage by sandhill cranes. And so currently, as Jason presented, that's Box Elder Ridge, Cache, and Uinta Basin. We don't currently have plans to do a hunt in Utah County, and primarily just because we haven't seen the densities of cranes down there as we have in other parts of the state. But there are ways to address the damage concerns. Those primarily have been funneled through Wildlife Services, the federal agency that deals with migratory bird damage. And so you're more than welcome to contact them, and I can get you their contact information. We also do have some resources available with the division as well for propane cans and things like that to address severe complaints. So if you are seeing that, contact our office, and we can get in touch with that as well.
Any other questions from the public on the presentation? Come forward.
In the packet I read, you had a different possession limit on mourning doves between falconers and gun hunters. How would you enforce that if someone hunted sometimes with a falcon and sometimes with a gun? They might have, say, less than 10 birds that they killed with a falcon, but less than 30 that they killed with a gun.
We have a law enforcement. Law enforcement.
I missed the first part of the question. What was your name, sir?
Joshua Black.
What was the first part I didn't hear?
The possession limit on mourning doves in the rule I read was different between falconers and gun hunters, where falconers were allowed 10 in possession and gun hunters were allowed 30 in possession. Okay. So what if somebody hunted sometimes with a gun and sometimes with a falcon, and how would that be enforced?
In the field, I'm hoping that our officers are going to be contacting you and realizing what you've been hunting.
But you would have a bag limit in the field and a possession limit in your freezer.
No, I guess you're talking us trying to go to your house or contacting you at your house to know.
Right, that's what I'm saying. The difference in possession limit doesn't make sense because it would be basically unenforceable. And how would you know if someone possessed 8 doves that they killed with a falcon versus 20 doves that they killed with a gun?
When you're talking your freezer at home, no, we don't. And we're going to deal with it as what we see in the field and what we're dealing with at that time. I can't account for what would or wouldn't be in a freezer or what you would or want to lie to me or tell me, I guess, in the field what you did or didn't have in your possession.
Okay,
I don't know. Did I am I missing the
No, it's
west
still really or? Vague. Because if I hunted sometimes with a falcon and they have a possession limit of 10, can I have 20 birds in my freezer if 10 of them were killed with a gun and 10 with a falcon?
Legally, yes.
Okay.
So could he have 40 then in possession?
I apologize. Okay, I was going to say, I'd have to see it on the paper in front of me to be able to answer that.
Yeah, so a lot of that comes back to what the Fish and Wildlife Service, the feds, will allow us to do. And so for falconries, they have a completely separate bag limit. And so for them, they can have three migratory birds in aggregation. They can have a combination of, say, during the waterfowl hunt, they can have two ducks and a dove, or one dove and two ducks. Or they can't have more than three migratory birds in a bag limit. And the possession limit is maxed out at three times a day the bag, so at nine. And so you could have, you know, nine birds that you'd take with your falcon, but you can have any more than that in possession. And then you could have an additional 21 that were taken with a gun. How law enforcement would determine that, I guess you'd have to identify each bird and how it was taken, I would assume. But that's something that a lot of that, the falconry bag and the hunter bag, are things that are dictated by the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. So
Blair, before you walk away, if I understand correctly, then the bag limit on the falconry is a federal issue, not something that we can control here.
Yeah, yep. So all that comes back to the federal framework.
And that's why the difference.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions from the public? Okay. Seeing none. I have some comment cards. First one up, Wayne Crawford. Would you like to come forward?
Well, I echo the comments earlier on the appreciation for the service of the RAC members here, and I don't have a gift for each one of you, but I will express and endorse the appreciation previously expressed. I guess the question has been asked and answered, but so at this point, this would formally translate into a request for reconsideration on the opener of the charker hunt. Just to address some of the concerns that it's too easy to hunt early in the season. I have seen a fair number of the guzzlers in the West Deserts, and I don't see a lot of shotgun pellet damage around there. I don't think they're getting a lot of shooting right on the guzzlers. I note that hunting over water holes is and has long been considered fair chase by Boone and Crockett, Pope and Young, regardless of any individual hunter's opinions contrary to that. It is an ethical way to hunt a variety of species. Most arguments against early season hunts, that it's giving you an unfair edge or advantage, could be as applicable to dogs. It is an advantage to have a dog in the field when you're hunting chukar. It is an advantage to the hunter in the field to be out in a limited water habitat early season on those hills around the guzzlers. And I don't know how many of you actually been out there chasing chukar, but I'm here to tell you there's no such thing as an easy chukar hunt. These guzzlers are purposely located in the steep, rocky hills, and you are chasing up steep hillsides looking for the coveys, not sitting there waiting for them to come in on a water hole. There's this misconception that the tightly clustered coveys are drinking from the guzzlers 24 hours a day and don't leave those unless they're chased off. That's false. They're actually on heightened alertness when they are into water. By instinct, they know that the predators are there, and that is where predation tends to be the highest. So they have minimal time on site at the guzzlers. The rest of the time, they're up on the steep hillsides. There was one other concern I have run into, that the riparian areas around guzzlers by design are to bring water where it is not, and the guzzlers are for the wildlife. The guzzlers are not irrigation systems to support riparian areas around the guzzler site. So if habitat protection was the goal, it's actually counterproductive, because if you get out there after some rains in the mud, there's more habitat damage than if you're out there on the dry hardpack. So I just request a reconsideration on that. Give me a couple weeks. If there's still concerns, the split season suggestion, in my mind, is a perfectly viable solution. So
okay,
be open to any questions.
Thank you, Wayne. Okay, thank you. Dwayne?
Yeah.
What's that last name?
Can you read my handwriting?
No. It's like mine.
I'm Dwayne Reading. I'm with Pheasants Forever.
Reading.
I'm with the local Salt Lake chapter, and I'm also here representing the Vernal chapter as well as the Cache County chapter. And we're just here to support the extended pheasant season. We think it clears up some confusion about the dates and where you can hunt and where you can't hunt. And it also, the research supports that it's a male-only hunt, always has been, well, not always has been, but is currently a male-only hunt, and the male-only hunt really doesn't affect the population of the birds. I don't think we'll ever get out there and find every male pheasant, no matter how long the hunt is. So that's my comment.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Jamie Nogle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jamie Nogle. I'm the district biologist for the National Wild Turkey Federation here in Utah. I just wanted to thank Jason Robinson for doing a great job of explaining his decision for not changing the season based off of none of the triggers have been met to change that. So hunters are satisfied. They're not feeling overcrowded. As an organization, we do support the recommendation to not change the current hunt structure. We believe that scientifically it makes sense, and so therefore we support not changing it.
Thank you. That's the last card I have for this section. Is there any other comments? Okay, seeing none, we'll bring it back to the board for your discussion. Chris.
I would like to make one thing on this. Could we vote on putting an action item to the board, to the wildlife board, on looking at the predator situation that involves the pheasants and all upland game?
Sure you can.
Well, I would like to propose that.
Okay. What's your proposal?
That we ask the wildlife board to use an action item to have the division look at predator control for all upland game, very much similar to what Sevier County has.
Okay, we have a motion on the table to place an action item for the Wildlife Board to consider concerning predators and their effects on upland game.
Yeah, a predator control situation.
Predator control program.
Uh-huh, for the upland game birds.
Okay. You good with that? You get that? Okay. We have a motion on the table. Do I see a second? Larry, second it. Okay, any discussion? Ben.
Ken, are you asking for this to be implemented statewide or in areas deemed necessary? What are you after here?
Statewide.
Okay.
Chris? Come on up.
I appreciate the sentiment on this, but I hope everybody realizes the Sevier County program is not funded by the division, and I think that this is, you know, would be a fairly expensive program. Probably going to take legislative action, would be my guess. But I think that one thing that before stepping into something as costly as this, I would probably want to talk with, or definitely would want to talk with Jason and Blair, and look at the upland game populations and find out where can we actually make an impact. And I think that to look at that part of it would be good, but looking at putting in a bounty program at this point, I think it'd be very premature.
Well, they could use that and going to set up a letter or whatever recommendation to the legislature to set money aside for that if they had to.
Okay. So what we have is a motion, a second, to place on the action log and recommend to the Wildlife Board to put it on an action log to look at that and possibly implementing some type of a predator control program concerning upland game. Is that fair enough? Okay, we can do that. Whether the Wildlife Board wants to do it or not, it's another thing. So let's go ahead and we'll call. Okay. Call for a vote on that. All in favor of this action item being recommended to the Wildlife Board? All in favor? Four in favor? Opposed? Okay, four opposed. Okay. All vote in favor? Okay, 5-4.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll move on to the next item. Russ Norvell.
We still need to vote on.
Yeah, we're not done. I keep getting ahead of myself. Okay. Okay, I'll bring it back to the board. Any discussion on this any further?
Yeah, I don't know if this is a question for Jason or Blair, but I'm wondering if we've had an early chukar hunt in the past and if that's been moved later because of what you talked about, or have we ever tried an early chukar hunt, even a split season or earlier season, anything like that with the chukar?
So we used to have, the season did open earlier, mid-September. I think it was about 6 years ago, maybe nine now. We moved it back from some of the research that we saw from BYU, looking specifically at chukar use of water sources, guzzlers in particular, and found that one of the critical pieces of that puzzle is the chicks that are hatched in the spring grow, use that water source quite a bit through the summer, and then we have what we call brood breakup, where the juveniles start to go out on their own. And that usually occurs early to mid-September. And so by moving the chukar season back to the end of September, it allowed those birds to be able to disperse, not be so reliant on those water sources, and allow basically that natural breakup to occur without hunters going in there prematurely and breaking up those broods on those water sources.
Okay, thank you. So in your opinion, then there's a biological reason for having it later in the season, or where you've put it?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. I have a comment as well.
Ron.
I was just going to say I have hunted chukar before, and I understand the first time's for fun, the second is for revenge. So I understand your thought process, but I'm kind of getting from you a little bit that because it is such a pain in the rear that you would like a little bit earlier because it might be a little bit easier versus watching them fly over your head and run down your – or, I mean, fly over and then run up the hill and go back over again. But I think if there is a biological reason, I think that we need to stick with that and make sure we have a healthy population. So I just want to make that on the record.
Okay. Thank you, Ron. Larry?
Jason, can you go back to the comment from Rob about the sandhill crane in Utah County? Is there a reason why sandhill cranes aren't hunted in this county? It's open for pheasant hunt, it's open for duck hunt, it's open for goose hunt. What are the reasons that the sandhill crane isn't?
That's a good question. We only get a certain number of cranes that we can shoot in the state each year. I mean, it's based upon an allocation we get through the flyway. And so we get about 12% or so of the total allocation comes back to Utah.
So that's from the federal government?
Yeah. Yeah, and currently with the number that we're getting, we could probably use quite a few more just to address damage issues throughout the state. And so we've chosen to put those permits in the four highest areas where we're seeing the highest amount of damage. And so it hasn't been as severe in Utah County as it has in some of those other areas, but it has been increasing. I know Wildlife Services has been working with a couple landowners in the county to get depredation permits for cranes and a few things like that. And so if that trend continues to, you know, show increasing birds in Utah County, then it's definitely something we could address. I guess currently we don't feel like it's at the same stage as those other areas, and so we put those permits in other spots. But
so it, how do you get more permits from the federal government?
Really, there's a harvest model that's based that's accepted by the flyway for all the states have sandhill cranes, and it's based upon the amount of habitat we have, as well as what the overall population is doing. And so it's bought in by all these states, and it's basically just a formula that predicts how many birds can be shot each year. And so to increase that, would probably have, or to change that, would have to probably tweak that formula a bit. And right now it's based on some of the best biological inputs we have, and so there's not a lot of adjusting we can currently do at this time without having detrimental impacts on the population.
Well, this is one of those things. I'm a huge supporter of Wildlife Services, but this is one of those situations where it could be an opportunity for the public to take a bird instead of Wildlife Services taking a bird.
Yeah.
But if your hands are tied on the numbers, I guess there's really not much we can do about it. Or is there something we could do about it?
Yeah, we can definitely start looking at this area and seeing what the crane numbers are doing. We do have a couple surveys that we do each year just to look at overall crane numbers, and we can probably evaluate that in the future. What we've seen in a lot of the areas like Box Elder County, they'll have cranes up there in hundreds of, you know, 500 or 600 in Box Elder and Cache County throughout the summer. So we see a lot of corn damage there, and so that's primarily why we've had a hunt there. Uinta Basin will get 5,000 to even 10,000 cranes that'll move through that area as well. So that's primarily why we've put in the more permits out there as well. And so if we do see crane damage continue to increase in Utah County, it's definitely something we can consider in the future.
Ben?
Yeah, I just wanted to address the split chucker hunt real quick. I believe I got the same email as you, Chris, and probably all of us. And correct me if I'm wrong, but as I understood it, the issue was as much access as anything, that the individual went out and it rained that weekend and made access difficult. I'm looking at the season dates, September 30th to February 15th. That's 4.5 month season. I don't think it makes sense to open it any earlier. As we've heard, there's a biological reason to keep it where it's at. And in 4.5 months, I mean, you ought to be able to find a weekend when access is possible. You know, we wouldn't consider moving a deer hunter or an elk hunt forward because it rained one year, right? So I can't support that, but that's my comments.
Thank you. Any other comments? Okay, I'll entertain a motion. Chris?
Go ahead.
Matt, go ahead.
My last motion. I would like to make a motion that we approve the upland game and turkey hunt table recommendations as presented tonight.
Okay. A motion on the table. We have a second. Ben? A second? Okay. Any other discussion? Okay. Call for a vote. All in favor of the presentation and motion? Voting is unanimous. Okay, thank you. Okay, now we can move on. Russ Norvell, Falconry Rule Amendments.
Mr. Chair, Board, I'm Russ Norvell, the Utah DWR Avian Program Coordinator for non-game species, and talking today about the falcon rule revision we're proposing. A little background first, for those of you who are not as familiar with falconry, it is the sport of kings, practiced for thousands of years And in currently in Utah, we have 253 permitted falconers with about 276 individual birds are in use, representing 26 raptor species. Five of those species are considered to be either state, threatened or endangered species, state-sensitive, conservation agreement species, or a birds or federal birds of conservation concern list species. So it does allow for use of birds with conservation concerns as well. 11 of those 26 are also are exotic species, or are they hybrids as well. The state has authority to regulate falconry since 2008 by federal action, which is the CFR reference there, 50 CFR 21.29. And our initial state rule was modeled very closely on the federal rule after extensive public input. But the rule has not been revised in over 5 years, and we face a different environment. We have emerging diseases that have to be taken into account. We have some new conservation needs, and thankfully we also have a number of resolved conservation issues that have passed us by. The sport of falconry is defined in rule as caring for and training raptors for the pursuit of wild game and for the hunting of wild game with raptors. This comes into play later as we talk about what species are usable for falconry. This rule covers three primary themes: hunting with raptors, the take of raptors from the wild, and the care of raptors as well. The rule also covers the importation and possession of raptors, the use of raptors in abatement activities such as at airports, and the captive propagation of raptors. So in hunting with raptors, raptors are a type of allowable weapon. The rule allows for the take of protected game species, primarily upland game and waterfowl. It also allows for take of unprotected species, such as the Eurasian collared dove, and the creation of. It also allows for the creation of special hunting seasons for falconry meets. The take of wild raptors for falconry is limited by a number of federal regulations. There's federal falconry rule itself, which provides the sort of the basement for our own rule. We can be more conservative, but we can't be more liberal than that rule. There's also the Endangered Species Act has some relevance, the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act, the list of federal birds of conservation concern, which is these days the de facto candidate species list for many species, for MBTA species. It's also through tradition, falconer experience level, and state level conservation and disease concerns, wildlife disease concerns. The care of raptor section is extensive in the rule. If you've looked at these, it's a long rule and has a number of parts, moving parts. These cover the standards for care, the standards for the facilities themselves, and for facilities inspections by law enforcement. This has intersects with a number of issues, including the fact that you can actually have facilities within one's home, so allowing for inspections is a delicate issue to be dealt with. The sport of falconry currently has three experience classes, the apprentice, the general, and the master. The apprentice is typically allowed to have one bird, just one of a few species, and typically only adult birds. That's a two-year period of time that someone serves as an apprentice falconer. General class are allowed more birds, more species, and more ages of birds. And there's a five-year duration of practice for that. Master falconers have practiced for at least a minimum of 7 years, and most or many more. And they are allowed to have multiple birds and any authorized species, although at this point golden eagles do require a special endorsement for experience handling and caring for very large raptors. The list of authorized species for each class is important for both legal, conservation, and practical reasons. The current rule has some issues. It's the federal standard was kind of a one-size-fits-some or most approach, so many of the complaints we've heard that it's hard to follow, it's difficult to enforce, and it's expensive to administer. Our current rule is also currently very long. It's complex and a little unique in the division's rule sets, in that it allows the use of native and exotic wildlife to take protected wildlife. It allows the possession of exotic species that would be otherwise prohibited under the CIT rule. It allows for a take of uncommon and high-priority conservation species. It also allows for the creation of special ad hoc licenses, locations, and hunting seasons. So in our revision goal, we had three basic goals. To invite the public into the process, so we had a really no-surprises approach. We wanted to very much simplify the rule, to clarify language and the intent, and also to shorten it overall. Overall, we wanted to make it easier to use, again, to improve compliance, ease enforcement, and quite honestly, ease administration as well. So to meet our first goal of public engagement, we held several informal outreach meetings with constituents. We've addressed well over 60 issues that have been brought up by UFA and other falconers, other groups as well. We've addressed many issues with administrative procedures as well. And we've gone through considerable consultation. We've, at this point, responded to hundreds of comments, email, voicemails, and in meetings. So our second goal is to simplify the rule. So this is why there is such an extensive amount of red in your red line copy. We wanted to clarify the language and intent. We grouped like sections to streamline the rule. We wrote entire sections to clarify the intent. We updated to match our list to the current Fish and Wildlife Service Bird of Conservation Concern list. The list that the BCC list in 2008 is an older version that our rule is currently dealing with. There are 11 species of raptors on that BCC list. The draft that's gone to Washington it's gone through Fish and Wildlife Service internal review. It's gone for review at the state level and been approved at all those levels. It's currently waiting for DC to sign off on it. That drops that list from 11 to 4. That's important for us since we feel a lot of our species are doing fine and ought to be removed from that list. But we do still wish to continue to respect the federal rule in our falconry rule. We've also updated references to the upland game and penured bird rules that Jason and Blair have worked on as well. So third goal, make it easier to use. We clarified some processes and lines of authority. So we updated our administrative processes and methods. So we've built a database, we've corrected contacts, we've added emails. We didn't used to track people's emails. So we've kind of brought that database up into the current, present. We've updated our forms and are working towards some more improvements there. We've added language to protect falconers in case of allowable birds a change in their conservation status. So if something got listed in the future, we've added some protections there. We've added take of adult American kestrels, as the current rule doesn't allow for that. But we've found that it's both hard to comply with, and it's also hard to enforce, as they look very, very similar. And we've also clarified that the authority for rule implementation derives from the division director, or designee, and the wildlife board only. So, clarified some of that. There are lots of small changes to this rule as well. So we've just made a lot of edits that have shortened the rule by over 5 pages. Over 80 corrections at this point. I think that's conservative. Typos, we've clarified some intent. We've updated citations. We've improved the rule construction to meet current state standards as well. We've incorporated authorized species tables into the text, which had been floating outside on the website. And we've restructured sections to strengthen and hopefully overall simplify the rule. So some of the big changes that are worth taking note. We've allowed, as I mentioned, the take of adult American kestrels by general and master class falconers. We would have liked to have done that for apprentices as well, but that's precluded by federal rule. We've increased the number of authorized species from the current 14 to 71. Most of these new additions are exotic species, but many are also native species. We've also defined a process by which more may be added by simply requesting this to the division director. We have also worked to reduce the waiting period between peregrine falcon and sensitive species permit draws. Typically there's a 2-year waiting period, and we can reduce that to allow for greater, more opportunity there for sportsmen. We've also allowed the quote-unquote eagle endorsement for general class falconers, because we need to rephrase this as somewhat of a special species endorsement so that general class falconers can handle some of the very large exotic eagle species that are not golden eagles per se. We have a number of changes that are not currently in this revision but are planned. So we're shifting to some online COR application processes. We're adding falconry CORs to the DWR app. And we're shifting to online annual reports. And we're, of course, updating the falconry database, which was just recently built. And that's my general gist. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Russ. Do we have any questions from the rack? Ben, go ahead.
Yeah, Russ. I'm looking at an email here that I got from the Utah Falconers Association with some comments that while you guys state that you're increasing the number of allowed birds that they can possess, that they're claiming the opposite, that it's being reduced. I'm trying to figure out where the discrepancy is. Do you
yes, sir.
Have any information on that?
Sure. The our current rule did not incorporate the table of allowable species, of which there's 14 species currently allowed. This was intentional back when it was done to allow for more flexibility, to allow the list of species to change without having to go through a full rack and board process. And that was what the intent was. However, that unknowingly violated state rule construction law regulations. So we want to incorporate the rule, those 14 species, that list, into the rule text, as should be, as for proper rule construction. At this point, we had extensive discussions with the falconry community as to why this was happening and what was the import. At that point, we opened up the list to basically add anything that was requested, to at least be reviewed, and that's how we got to where we are. A number of species were sort of redlined out for either they were inappropriate for use as falconry species, they're nocturnal, they're insectivorous, they only eat carrion, that sort of thing. And a number, those were, and then the rest of the list was reviewed, if I may. I have a slide that might help clarify. So we've used a rule set here to help clarify what species were the state of Utah is comfortable allowing to be imported, either for not just for falconry. This same rule set, though, we hope to use for the CIT rule revision, which will be coming before you here, I guess not super soon, but soon enough. This is the same process that we hope to use for that rule as well. So we're trying to be consistent between rules. There are four basic criteria. One is, is the bird able to be legally possessed and legally possessable? What's its conservation status? For example, is it threatened or endangered? What's the importation risk? We looked at the number of subcategories here, risk to human health and safety, potential for establishment as an exotic species in the wild, and the consequences of what that establishment might have. And again, like I mentioned, the suitability for falconry, so nocturnal species and insectivorous species were pretty much lined out. We also, though, wanted to clarify that there are other pathways to possession. So if someone wants to have a species that is not perhaps suitable for falconry, you can go through the CIT rule for possession. That's another valid approach. As I mentioned also, you can go through a process by simply, it's a simple process, there's no variance committee or anything like that. You just got to ask the director for a species if it's not on that list already. And we tried hard to make sure that list did, in fact, include all the species that are commonly used for falconry to start.
So I want to see if I can maybe just sum this up and reword it a little bit. For legal reasons, you had to change the rule to be in compliance with what, federal code?
Some federal code, mostly state rule construction. Also, the rules should be revised every 5 years or more.
And if I'm understanding this correctly, before it was a restrictive list, in other words, the list restricted what you could have, and now it's a permissive list?
Sure. Yes, that's true. Well, actually, that's not entirely true. The list is still permittive. It was permittive in the first case. Our rules are constructed so that you can't hunt with any weapon except a rifle during rifle season or archery in archery season. Our rules are constructed the same way. You can't hunt with anything but this list of allowable species.
Okay, so I guess my follow-up question would, this change in rule, how many falconers does this affect currently with birds that may be affected by this rule change? And if any, what is their, are they grandfathered in, I guess?
No and yes. At this point, there are no falconers, to our knowledge, that have CORs or have permits for species that are not on the approved list or the new list. And there is a clause to allow for a process to incorporate, to allow for an establishment of COR.
Thank you.
Greg, do you have something you'd like to state?
Please.
Greg is one of the attorneys in the Wild Divisions.
Yeah, Greg Hansen with the Attorney General's Office. I was just going to help support Russ with that question on the historic list. And, you know, for enforcement purposes, if we're identifying species that are allowed for the use in falconry, the appropriate spot for it is in rule. While it would be much more convenient and possibly more flexible to have it just as a year-to-year established list that we post on our website, if we are going to identify a specific list beyond that floor basement that's established in the federal rule, the appropriate spot for it is in our administrative rule.
Okay. Thank you. Chris, have you got George? Chris.
Yeah, thanks, Russ. So I got a few follow-up questions from Ben. So within the email we received, there was also a copy of a letter from the North American Falconers Association that said, based on the change of this rule, they will pull Vernal, Utah from the rotation of annual field meets. So that seems like a fairly significant action. They claim that they bring somewhere around $300,000 annually to the local economy. And the reason being is because the rule is so different from any other state in the contiguous 48. Can you talk about the rule compared to other states around us and why you think maybe they would take that action they feel strongly enough about this that what are your thoughts on that?
Sure. Be happy to. I'll look, I have a slide for this too, actually. And NAFA produces a national meet every year, the North American Falconry Association. And that's one of the difference between a meet and a trial is a trial is a group of falconers get together and hunt unprotected wildlife, so pen-raised birds, etc. No special permits are required for that. For a meet, however, they're going to take protected wildlife, and this requires we present a 5-day non-resident meet license, which used to, in the old rule, require board approval, and now we've shifted that down to a director level to make it a little bit easier. Recognizing that there may be some species that on a national or even international falconers list that isn't on ours, we've allowed for two processes to allow that to happen. One, the meet organizer can do a bulk listing, and so go through approval process for the director. It's kind of a one, so all the applicants can just apply to the meet organizer and have that go through that process, or they can apply individually to the director for approval. This approval, the director is going to have to go through the same process as we've done for our native falconers, though, because we don't have an equitable, paritable parity on that process. As to the point of how different is our rule from other states, I can't speak for the whole country. I know some states, like I think Connecticut, prohibits falconry entirely. Many states just use the federal rule as the basement. They just don't even regulate it whatsoever beyond the federal. We don't find that's a great fit for Utah and for Utah's needs. Other states in the area, Colorado, Alaska, in the flyway, Montana, all do regulate both importation, take of native species to some level already. So we're in that same ballpark. We're not far out in left field there.
Okay, so a couple questions to follow up with that. So, one, you mentioned that you felt like that a less restrictive list didn't meet our needs. Could you expound on that a little bit?
A less aside from
I understand that, you know, we had to make a rule and put it into place, but it seems like the rub seems to be the number of species that are on the list. And I understand we have a mechanism to add species.
Mm-hmm. And that we've worked hard to add everything that was requested.
But it seems like our list might be more restrictive than, say, neighboring states.
That's true. Yep.
And so you said that was done intentionally to meet our needs.
Correct.
Could you expound on that a little bit?
Certainly. So when we went through those criteria, we wanted to make sure that we are doing, basically this is a risk management exercise. These are for events that have not happened, but we sure don't want to have happen. Either an establishment of a wild species, it's a fairly low risk, and I think it's well documented in the literature that's not a huge concern. Importation of wildlife diseases is another big one that is of serious concern to us, since we have a changed landscape in this in the past decade or so. No one was ever talking about West Nile virus, you know, 10 years ago, really. These are some of the qualities that we have to respect with the rule, and we felt that this was a reasonable approach to finding sort of a suitable middle ground there, while still allowing falconers. I mean, the Division of Wildlife is, of course, first and foremost about providing sportsman opportunity, and that's been our bottom line. So we were looking to protect our mission at the same time as providing as much opportunity as we can through this process. So.
Okay, last question. So did I have it right that right now the list is at 71 species? Right?
Yes, I believe so.
Because in our packets it says 54, so I want to make sure I have that right.
Okay, I'll have to double check. Actually,
you got the list.
We can clarify.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
If you wait just a sec. Are there questions in the meantime?
I was just curious, when you referenced the BCC list, I thought Utah had two BCC regions, and they each had their own list. Is the raptor list for both those regions the same? And so you guys just refer to that as one BCC list? Or
actually, Utah has four BCCs. There's a little tiny big chunk of Grace Basin, big chunk of Colorado Plateau, little piece of Mojave Desert, and a little piece of the Wyoming Basin up there in Rich County on the north slope of the Uintas. But we simplified in the rule map. The map basically is going to follow I-15 down to Cedar City and shoots off west from there. That is a complication. We anticipated when we drafted this that the BCC list, the 2017 list, would be approved by now, or 2016, because it was drafted in 2015. It's been held up in D.C. We're all just waiting for their shoe to drop at this point. We don't have conservation concerns for the species in the state anymore. That used to be prominent. Back in 2008, this was more of an issue then. Especially for, say, prairie falcons in some counties. At this point, the numbers seem good, and we're not concerned about that. And so we approve of the changes that the feds have proposed. If they would just go ahead and endorse them, we'd pull them right into the rule. But we did want to make sure that the rule did continue to respect that federal watch list, essentially, because that's part of our responsibility, honestly.
Okay.
So my apologies. To answer your question, 54 is where we're at right now.
Okay.
So my apologies on the. I think 71 was the initial requested list, and we took off some like flaminid owls and things.
I have a couple questions. I received a letter from the Audubon Society, from Great Salt Lake Audubon, and a couple things that they brought up in here had to do with the species that are conservation concern species, and how the rules that we're changing to allow some of those four big species to be added to our list, how will that affect how will you manage, you know, if that we start to see a decline, can you then delist them off of species that can be taken?
At this point, I think to make changes to this list would go through a full rack and board process. So if there were a conservation concern that emerged in the future about one of the species that we're proposing to allow here, we would have to go through a full revision process. To remove that. Of course, I think the director can, correct me if I'm wrong, this is my very first RAC meeting, so correct me if I'm wrong, can
have emergency closures and modify rules as needed under emergency action. So if a species was listed, there we go.
The director under his emergency closure authority could close the season to wild take, but as far as general possession, that would require a rule change. And quite honestly, if the bird was captive bred, that might not be an area we'd be willing to get into. So,
does that answer your question?
Any other questions from the rack? Okay, any questions from the public? Come forward, state your name, please.
Sure. My name is Justin Searle. I'm a master class falconer. So just a couple questions, Russ. First off, that list of 14 that you mentioned, did that list of 14 ever go through the rack and the board process and approved by the rack and the board?
No, it did not. I think the point here is that this list is going before the rack and board now.
Okay. And was this list ever referred to in the falconry rule?
Nope.
And according to the legal counsel, without going through the rack and board, there's no way that we can actually change any restriction around possession. The only thing we can actually change is restrictions around take.
What a pitch that would have
been. Could you clarify?
You stated just a minute ago that without going through a full rack and board process, there's no way that the state can make any changes to the possessions that falconers can, or the birds that falconers can possess. They can only make changes to the rules around take, what we can actually take from the native species here. Because in falconry we have the take where we actually can get a license to remove one from the wild.
Wild take and, yeah.
But possession is different.
I guess the proposal before the RAC right now is for including the species list into the rule. So it's a proposal moving forward. I guess is your question whether the historical 14 bird list is an enforceable?
Yeah, what is the legal state of that list of the 14 birds, since it was never went through the RAC and the board process and does not occur anywhere in the rule?
It's a very good question. Fortunately at this point, we haven't identified a conflict situation where there is a bird currently in possession that would fall outside of that 14 bird list.
Okay.
Now that's why we're here today, to propose including a species list in the rule.
Okay. And Russ, on your presentation, you on one of your earlier lists, you had a list of how many different species are currently in possession in the state of Utah by falconers, which is greater than the number of 14. Correct.
Yes, it includes exotics and hybrids, however, which are not currently on that list. Some of that list was not inclusive of hybrid crosses and such. So deer, falcon, peregrine crosses.
The hybrids have always been counted as whatever the parentage is.
That earlier list was just whole full species.
Okay. So but you said that it does include exotics as well.
The current
number of falconers or falcons that are currently in possession in the state of Utah?
Yes.
Okay. So therefore, these exotics that are currently in possession are not on the current list of 14, but yet they still are in possession in the state of Utah.
Well, see.
So therefore, that list of 14 does not accurately represent, or was never enforced for falconers.
Actually, let me pull that up one second.
Okay.
Let's see, we've got, there are species that are listed as exotic that are sourced from exotic locales but are not recognized as full species. So, for example, European goshawk. There are a number of subspecies of exotic falcons that are also not recognized as full species but are commonly distinguished in the falconry community because they're unique enough. I think that along with the hybrids, of which there are nine, constitutes, that's the difference between the 14 and the 26.
And then my final question is according to the falconry rule that has gone through the rack and the board process and is approved, approximately how many species is currently allowed according to the falconry rule for possession?
according to the rule or according to...
According to the falconry rule that has gone through the RAC process and the board process.
The rule allows, is the federal standard of the three families.
The three families, which represents over 500 species.
Right. In policy and practice, the table that has lived outside the rule has been our guidance for this ever since then. I've spoke to the coordinator who proposed the rule back and drafted the rule back in 2008, and that was always the intention of that construction. The way the rule was constructed on purpose that way, it was just incorrectly done.
Thank you.
Can I ask a clarifying question real quick to Russ?
Okay, let me...
Russ, there's a couple of us up here that are confused. The list of 14 that keeps getting referenced, if I understand that correctly, that's a federal list of 14 species that are not legal to be possessed right now. Do I understand that correctly?
Not quite, no. The federal rule allows any raptor species in three large families.
Okay, so what is the list?
Everything worldwide that you might consider a raptor.
So what is the list of 14 that we keep referring to?
The list of 14 was, in 2008, was Utah's list of allowable species to be used for falconry. These are the weapon types, if you will.
Okay, so not birds. Okay, that's the opposite of what I was thinking. So a falconer could possess birds beyond that list of 14, but they could only hunt with a bird from that list of 14.
Correct, although the possession would be regulated under the CIT rule, not falconry rule. If they're not going to hunt with them, it's not a weapon type. It's a pet.
Okay. And if I remember right, there was that list of 14 was changing to a list of 54. 54. Okay. Does that help out anybody? Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
It is a confusing rule with many moving parts.
Is there any other questions from the public? Come forward.
Hello, Russ.
Just tell your name, please.
Patrick Shane. My understanding, and I think I probably might be the oldest living falconer in Utah, is that we've never had a list for falconry. That 14 number that you quoted back in 2008 was never intended to be a list to tell falconers what they could fly. It just happened to be a list of birds, but it was never part of anything that it went before anybody, and it really exists in a written copy that was never intended to be an all-encompassing list. Is that correct?
Do you have a question for him? And we'll get to the comment period in a sec. Yeah. Okay, thanks. Any other questions from the public? Okay, we'll close that. Now we have some comment cards. I'll give your name and you come up and give your comment. Patrick Shane.
Thank you, Patrick Shane. I want to thank, by the way, thank this group here for your labor of love. For the our wildlife hunting and resources and everything we do, and I want to thank Russ and the people that we met with for many, many hours back here, Larry and the federal attorneys and Jessica, for all of your help. We've had some long meetings and they've been incredibly helpful, and the information that we've seen up here is a great example of all their hard work. Thank you for all the hard work you've done. We as falconers and me as an individual, I don't have a problem with what they presented except for one single thing. Everything they've done up there is an improvement. There is one problem, and that's the list. There's really never been a list, and there shouldn't be a list. The federal people don't require a list. The states around, to answer someone's question, around Utah don't have a list. And there's no reason to have a list. It would be more restrictive than the federal and the people around the state. So we're in favor of everything on here except for that list. I am as a individual, and there's really no place for this. It's not necessary. It's uncalled for. And the real bottom line here comes down to, and I'll quote Clayton White, a retired BYU professor who's one of the experts in raptors. There's absolutely no science that would support having this list. He clearly states, and there is no scientific evidence anywhere that suggests otherwise, that we could release all the birds that we have, all the hybrids, all the falcons and hawks that we now possess in Utah, and there was, what, 270-something of them, and it would never bastardize the population, the wild population out there. It would have no effect. There's no need for a list.
Thank you. Okay, Shane Clark.
Keep all the Shanes together.
I appreciate the opportunity to speak. I've been a falconer here in Utah for about 30 years. Like Patrick said, I appreciate the work that's been done. Russ's first goal was to get public input, and we appreciate his openness in doing that. And I, too, it comes down to the list. The federal regulation simplified things, and we appreciated that. And my concern is that just trying to explain the changes and the list is more complicated. It seems like it's made it harder rather than easier. And I think that that we should keep it simple. I think that the science doesn't support the list, and I would just like to go on record to say that I don't think there's a need for it, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Okay, Randy Height.
I want to say thank you to all of you that have made comments already. I can already tell that you've gotten into the email that we've already sent out. There's so much involved in this. It's not just a small thing. I represent the Utah Falconers Association as a past president. The president tonight is administering finals down at UVU. He's a math professor down there. Pardon me. I'm so excited about this. I'm shaken. I'm that passionate about this. Please don't let this list pass. This list has no place in falconry. Falconry predates the Division of Wildlife, predates the Fish and Wildlife Services. Our definition of falconry goes way beyond what the division has. A good example, and I'm sure everybody has probably even read a book about somebody flying a Merlin on starlings. Beautiful ringing up flight, get all the starlings in their little undulations, taking a single bird down the ground. Everybody knows that. That's not considered falconry to the Division of Wildlife, because starlings are not a game animal. That is still falconry, and presenting a list creates a catch-22. You can't possess a falconry bird without practicing falconry. That's what the annual report's for, to show that you're practicing falconry, that you're catching game. In falconry, it's not that tightly defined. But to have a Merlin, you have to have a falconry license. So, catch 22 there. Did you catch what Mr. Hansen said there when you asked him directly about the list? Where is it referenced? It's now in the rule. And he says if there is going to be a rule or a list, it should be in the proclamation. It's never been codified. It's never been in there. And he'll agree now that we've said that after Mr. Searle approached that. The division hasn't been straightforward with us in this. They created a division within our club so deep that people that we thought were going to be long-term friends will never talk to each other again. And that's because they convinced half the group, or a third of the group, that there is a list that is codified in the rule. And it will be enforced unless we let them put this list of 71 birds in place. There is, in fact, a list in the Utah rule. If you look at that, if you remember your email right there, this is from the rule. It says, the only species of raptors that may be possessed, transported, or used for falconry are raptors of the subfamily, Accipitridae. Other than the bald eagle, Hylatus accipitris, so that's an exception. They say don't use the bald eagle. Raptors of the subfamily, Falconidae. Great horned owl, I can't even say that one, Bubo virginius, and captive bred Eurasian eagle owl, Bubo Bubo, of the family Stringidae. That is a list, and that's what's in the Fish and Wildlife Services. That's a very broad list and represents about 500 species. So they're proposing that we're going from a list of 14 birds that have never been codified to 74 is not true. They're trying to take us from a list of 500 species down to 71. So why is that important? Why would we want to fly somebody that's... Part of that is because our definition of falconry is broader than what they have, but you still have to have a falconry COR to possess some of these birds. Some of these birds haven't been tested yet. Some of these exotics, you know, only until about 25 years ago, people thought that Harris hawks were just a lazy buzzard. They didn't think they would be any interesting, didn't think they would be any good for falconry, but they're now one of the most popular birds because they're unique. They like to fly together. They're the only raptor that you can actually get to fly together in a group and hunt jackrabbits and cottontails, sometimes ducks, and sometimes pheasants, but they prefer fur. But this also, this list is going to create more problems for the state as well. It was mentioned that the National Falconry Association has already sent out the letter, if you pass this rule, or if you pass the list, we're striking Utah from the national meets. This will be an economic impact, and I don't think the division has done any economic impact studies on what that would actually entail. But I'm sure that you'll hear from that from the Southeast region when we visit down in Vernal. Also, is going to create a problem with two more minutes. Okay. Also, going to create a problem with training. There's already been a case where somebody's bird has been confiscated. This is private property that has been purchased from a breeder. It was a bird that's from Peru. It was thought it was a rare species and it was taken away from this person. This type of thing is going to happen more and more frequently with this list.
Thank you. Justin Searle.
Thank you. And also, let me also, like the other falconers, say thank you to Russ and his team. They really have been good to work with, and we've seen eye to eye on almost every single issue except for this list. I think to simplify it, you've heard many different versions of it. I know many of you guys may have dogs, may hunt with dogs. Can you imagine having any option of any dog breed that you can possibly have, but then have the DWR go through and list specifically, you can only hunt with these five dogs if you're hunting pheasants? The list simply doesn't make sense. Currently, the federal rule allows us to have over 500 different species. Basically, any falcon, any owl, any hawk that we're allowed to hunt that exists, we can hunt lists, unless it's been something specifically listed as something that is in danger to the environment. I think we don't want to bring a bird into this state that's going to be a hazard to this state and a hazard to our wildlife. And if the DWR has a concern about a specific species, we'd be right there with them, supporting them if there was a justifiable concern for a specific species. So having a permissive list saying, yes, follow what the federal government says with the over 500 lists of birds that we currently can have according to the U.S. government, as well as the 500 birds that specifically is stated inside of the Utah falconry rule with the three different subfamilies that's currently permitted, we're on board with that. If we need to go ahead and blacklist specific birds that are a problem, we would support that. But trying to go through and actually do the opposite of saying specifically only these species are allowed simply doesn't make sense. It's trying to solve a problem where no problem really exists.
Okay. Thank you, Justin. I have no more cards. Is there any other comments? Okay. I have a question. Why is there a list?
Why is there a list? Yep. Fundamentally, we limit all types of take, with weapon types. This is how we construct our rules, and this is, I think, an appropriate approach. Given that falconry is unique and that you're using a live creature to take other protected wildlife, and that's why our rule is focused on the take of protected wildlife. That's our management authority. We don't authorize take on unprotected wildlife. The list is in an effort to respect and promote sportsman opportunity where we can in a way that it also respects our dual mission to conserve wild populations and respect federal regulation where we need to, and also to guard, quite frankly, safeguard human health and safety issues. The list itself is constructed to be as permissive as possible, and that's something because we do not want to limit opportunity where we can avoid it. And that's, as I hope I've gotten to your question there.
Are there raptors that are really dangerous to humans?
There are raptors that are potentially dangerous to humans. I think a lot depends on training. I mean, the harpy eagle is one. I think both the two we've gotten received at least three comment letters about the harpy and the martial eagles, which are two of the largest raptors in the world. They're phenomenal species. They're very large.
Okay.
Yeah. A lot depends on temperament, though, too, which is not something that's well documented. It's not like you can look up temperament in a database.
I mean, can you train any of these birds to hunt only specific protected game, or will they hunt anything that moves?
I am not a falconer, so I can't say that. I understand that they have preferences and skill sets that are appropriate to certain types, and you can probably train them to focus on grouse or rabbits through behavior, but they're fairly broad for the most part.
I just really questioned the danger involved this.
We tried to be very conservative. When we went through this protocol, again, like I mentioned, this is the same procedure that we are evaluating for use in the CIT rule for all, that would regulate all importation of all exotic species, from kangaroos to bats to anything else. So we're trying to find, this is the risk assessment rule set we settled upon, and this is the first go-around with it.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments from Ron? Ron.
My understanding is you have no problem with the rest of the rule besides the 14. Is that pretty much accurate on that? I guess I have a tough time in life being restricted. That's a tough one for me, especially if it's good enough for our federal government to have 500. I don't know, we need to go to 14, just personally. I haven't heard on the news anytime recently where an eagle's taken a child up in the air or been dive bombed by a hawk. I have seen some mountain lion problems, but that's a whole different story by itself. So I guess I'm a little bit with you, Richard. I don't see the immediate danger on where we're at already. I understand where you're coming from, but it's easier to try to have some order to what you're looking for and what you're doing. But I'm just wondering if we're trying to tackle too big of a thing at the same time when it doesn't appear to be a problem yet. And maybe a little overreactionary from my point of view.
So this one's a tough one for me. I'm kind of struggling with this one, and you know, the federal government gave the states some rights back in the day. One big one is water, and the other one's wildlife. And the state has a right to manage wildlife to the benefit of their citizenry, and that's why every state is probably not on the same boat when it comes to this rule or any other wildlife rule or whatever, because states can't differ on that, and so they don't have to be the same as Arizona or Nevada or Colorado or anything like that. So this one's a tough one for me. So
Ben, and then Chris.
Russ, first of all, you've been extremely informative tonight, so thank you for that. It's been much appreciated. Question, obviously, the dispute here is about this list, and I get the feeling that the DWR wants a list in the rule codified. Is there any reason we couldn't change the definition of that list and instead of listing these 54 species, list, as these guys are requesting, the three families of birds as defined by the federal government?
That is certainly one possibility. As I understand it, this is the public process. We've gone through all
sure.
this internal machinations and the in reaching, so to speak, to bring you a proposal that the Wildlife Board is the final arbiter.
So how much, I mean, I'm just trying to get a feel, what would the, how much opposition from the DWR would be, would there be to do that? I mean, is this a little thing, or is this, you know, monumental?
It would, from my perspective, I think it would take away our ability to manage manage risk. That has not yet occurred, and we hope to avoid. But that's one of the tools we'd like to keep in our kit. The list, I don't think there'd be a functional difference if you permitted all three families the feds allow versus going with the list of 54 that are the commonly used and requested, most requested species, with an option for adding additional species as requested. Functionally, I think the number of different types of birds being flown in Utah wouldn't change. I would hope that NAFA would reconsider its position, given that we absolutely do not seek to limit having a meet in Utah.
Okay. Bill, you look like you've got something to say.
Yeah, I guess I'd like to address this. I think there's a point that's being missed, and I think maybe we maybe articulated our intention poorly with this. We want to have this list to let falconers know what species are approved for use. However, as Russ explained, we've put into place a procedure where if somebody wants to fly something that isn't on the list, we just all they have to do is just ask us, and we take it through the same criteria. So I think when you're talking about risk to human health and safety or risk to the environment, it's not the risk of having an eagle come in and carry off a small child. The risk is more something to do with like avian influenza or some disease we don't even know about now yet, or some ecological catastrophe that could happen that we might learn more about in the future. So all we've really tried to put into place is a mechanism where, you know, we've gone through a list of every species that they've asked us to look at so far, and we've said, okay, yeah, of the 71 species that you asked us about, here's 54 we're okay with, but if you would like others in the future, here's a procedure that we'll use to where we can approve those. So, you know, maybe what way we should be wording this is we have this list of 54 species that is approved, but if you want to have anything from the other three families approved by the Fish and Wildlife Service, here's a procedure to get those considered. I imagine it's going to be a very short turnaround. You know, basically the request will come to Russ. He'll run it through the same kind of procedure he did with everything else. It could be done in short order. So I think I hope that clarifies what we're trying to accomplish. So we're just trying to have a way to check something that might come up in the future we don't know anything about right now.
So, Bill, you mentioned that the biggest concern is the, you know, bringing in wildlife disease. How common is that? What have we seen here in Utah or even in the West?
Well, you just never know. We've had HN5N, we've had avian influenza, chronic wasting disease. You know, who knows what's going to come up in the future from what species? You know, it's just something we don't know about right now. So this is just a procedure for checks and balances. You know, if they have another species they want us to consider, you know, we'll by all means consider it.
So can you outline again, or one of you outline again real quick for me the procedure? If the species is not on the list, what it would take to get approved for that species?
It's a specific request to the division director, and because we don't know what some of those future concerns or issues might be, and we don't know which species we'd be specifically addressing, you know, that process isn't super definite in the rule. I would anticipate that it would look something very similar to the process that the division went through in identifying the currently proposed list. You know, one of the main issues being whether the species is suitable for the sport of falconry, and if they've gone through the conservation and disease, analyses. And Russ might be able to weigh in a little bit more on that, but that process is proposed in the rule both for the resident falconers and for the meets and trials section when non-residents who may be lawfully possessing a bird in their state want to come into our state and it doesn't specifically meet the list. And my understanding is that the currently proposed list is expansive enough that those situations would be pretty rare, but we're ready to address them. So
Greg, let me ask, doesn't the division reserve in rule the right to terminate or not allow a certain species in there because of biological or disease issues that have come up? I mean, don't they do that already?
In other rules, we do. In our general CIP, the collection, importation, and possession rule, we do have processes put in place for some of those more sensitive or high risk species. The falconry rule is somewhat different because we have a framework given to us from Fish and Wildlife Service that creates kind of a baseline floor. But then we're specifically given the authorization in the CFR provisions to create a state program that is at least as restrictive as the federal program, but can be more restrictive.
Okay, thank you.
So on that process to get approved, that would not have an individual wanted a species that's not on the list. It wouldn't go through the RAC and Wildlife Board process. It would go to,
nope,
to the director.
If the board approved the rule as proposed, the director would have the authority to independently approve species not currently on the list.
One comment real quick, Ron, then I'll hand it over to you. I struggle with that a little bit because I kind of feel like that's director roulette. You know, what's the director's opinion on that and knowledge of the subject? And just in, I'll wrap up. I'm going to echo Ron's comments. I like freedom, and I don't like being restricted when there's not a good reason to. And I don't know if I'm comfortable with this exception process as it is. And I kind of think these guys have put up a good argument to back that list off to, you know, the federal government standards. So.
1 second, Ron. I've been waiting for a sec here. So I've got a question. So I get it. You don't like the list. I hear that. But, you know, there is a part of me that, you know, federal guidelines don't always work locally. But let me ask this, particularly the gentleman that represents UFA. Do you see a compromise here? Is there a couple species that are a rub? Is it just the list in general, or is there something behind that?
Thank you for giving me the chance to answer that. Compromise is really self-governing. A lot of these species we're not going to want to fly, and just like Russ said, very likely if the list did go into effect, it wouldn't change the number of birds or the type of birds that we have right now, but it would prevent us from exploring those other options and finding the next Harris's hawk or the next harpy eagle or Bonelli's eagle, finding some exciting birds and actually being able to fly them. It would prevent other people that own them from coming and visiting us in the state and flying just as friends. We would always have to be going outside of the state to do that. And while I have the mic, I just want to address the health, safety, and disease issue. you know, they said that there's a concern about importing other diseases, but I want to direct this directly to Russ. Russ, how did we find out about avian influenza?
Oh, with falcon. It was one of the first reports in the U.S. was from a falconer.
Right. Newcastle's was found in the feed source for falconry, and West Nile virus was pushed very stringently by falconers back east because it was hitting them hardest. So there is a personal investment in watching the health and the status. We love these birds. We're committed to these birds, okay. And everybody knows the story of the DDT.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And that makes sense. But on the other hand, I get the reason for the rule as well. I guess what I was asking, is it the federal standard or bust for you guys? Okay. All right. Thank you.
I guess my comment on that, when you get a bird and in Falconry, you need to register that bird with your to get your permit. And so everyone knows what bird you have already anyway, correct? And they already have a list. So if you actually were had a certain issue with a certain species, then it wouldn't be that hard to find out who owned that species of bird or that particular deal if it became a problematic situation, which I don't really expect. But at that same point in time, there is a database where anybody who's actually actively doing falconry, that type of database is already there, so everyone knows what everybody pretty much owns that's in the state. Is that correct?
Almost. We issue non-specific capture permits. So these are, and facilities are inspected before birds are put in place, so they are inspected with the potential for birds, but not actual birds yet. So we don't actually know until the annual report's turned in. At that point, that's a self-reporting mechanism, and then we learn what birds are held.
Okay, I guess that was just a follow-up I have. I just feel like we have ways of tracking what's going already in your industry going, and I guess the point I look at is I just don't understand why the clarification needs to go down to so many different smaller species if we haven't already had that issue. I understand we could be afraid of disease and different things like that, but we hunt big game, and chronic wasting disease is in big game in certain areas of the state. We hunt a lot of different animals can carry different diseases, and so I guess I just don't sense the urgency of restriction, I guess, is probably my point.
Okay. Any other comments from the RAC? Okay. Ken.
I just got one thing to say. I went out to Fairfield years ago with Gerald Richards, and I watched one of these falconry things. And at that time, I raced racing homers, and they would borrow them for their competition. And once they got missed by a hawk, they never got caught. But what I want to say is it was a sign of pure love. Those guys watched over them birds, and if they had them out on a stake and an eagle flew by, they knew what was going on, and they protected their birds to a T. And so I really think it's an interesting setup, and I think they love their birds, and I don't think they're going to allow anything, any disease or anything else. They don't want to bring it in into the area.
Mr. Chairman, are we ready for a motion?
We're ready.
I would move that we accept the division's recommendation with one exception, and that exception pertaining to the list, that we remove the list of 54 and replace it with the list of the three families as governed by the federal government.
Okay, we have a motion. We have a second. We have a second by Ron. Any other discussion?
I think that before we vote, I just want to say I don't oppose the list in thought, but I think, in my view, I think the DWR should work more with UFA to come up with a little bit better solution around what that structure would look like. I understand the concept, what you're trying to do, but I think absent of some major reason why we should restrict the list to 54 species, it's hard to go that direction for me. But so I would just encourage you guys to find a different solution, in my opinion.
Okay.
To that I would add, I think I'd be more comfortable with the list if the process to get an exception to the list was a little better defined and outlined. But to play director roulette, Greg's a pretty good guy. I like him. I think he'd be pretty reasonable. Who's the next director? I don't know, you know.
Okay, we have a motion on and a second on the table. We'll call for a vote. All in favor of the motion as stated? 6 in favor. Any opposed? 2. 2 opposed. So the motion passes. 6-2. Okay. Any other discussion? We're good, aren't we? Okay. Thank you for being here. And just remember the Wildlife Board meeting. And the RAC Committee, you need to stay here at this point. Ben, you're not leaving, are you? Okay. We need to have some elections. Hey, George, don't leave. Yeah, we've got a.
Got to find a vote for a new chair and vice chair. Hey, you've been extremely informative. You did a great job.
Great work you did.
Don't leave.
What's that?
You got to vote for a chair and vice chair.
Good luck to the rest of that.
You got to leave. Don't leave. You have to choose a new chair and vice chair.
I'm out?
That's right. You get to vote.
Yeah.
I've been here 10 years. I got on and I filled out a term of one person of a guy for 2 years, and then they grabbed me 2 more 4 years. So I'm ready to move on. Been a great education.
One whole new high school. Hey, ready?
Yeah, thank you.
No, we're doing it for the money.
I got voted into something.
I don't have to change. Here, 1 second.
Ron, come on back. Let's get started and let's get this done. Yeah. Okay, RAC Committee, if you can have your seats, let's go ahead and let's get this process started. Get to go and bother the